Hi everyone, Drew Prode here, today with another mini episode for you with Dr. Gábor Máté. And on today's mini episode, we're talking all things addiction and trauma and pain. You know, anybody that's suffering from any type of addiction, not just things like alcoholism or drugs, we can talk about people having a shopping addiction. We can have people having an addiction to people pleasing. Dr. Gábor asks an important question. He asks, don't ask why the addiction, ask why the pain. Addictions are used to cover pain up in our life. And once you understand this, you have a whole different approach to the negative patterns and addictions that we have in our life, not just for others, but for ourselves too. So on today's mini episode, Dr. Máté is going to be talking about how painful experiences or trauma are at the center of all addictions. He's also going to be talking about understanding the difference between responsibility and blame and why it's not all our parents' fault, so to speak. He's going to be talking about what is happening physiologically in the brains of addicted people. And lastly, he's going to be talking about the key to healing painful experiences. If you're curious about breaking addictions down, taking away their power by addressing their root cause of pain, identifying it and healing it, today's mini episode is absolutely for you. I think for a lot of individuals, there is a quote of yours that I shared the other day on social media, and your work for a lot of individuals is the detangling of their life experiences and what they see of themselves now. And the quote that I shared, which is one of your quotes, was anything that is wrong with you, and you wrote wrong in quotation marks, began as a survival mechanism in childhood. Yeah. I would love if you could expand on this quote in the context of your work.
So take anything like addiction. So addiction is a bad thing, right? And it's a sin, or it's a mistake, or it's a bad choice, or it's a disease. It's none of that. When you ask people, when I give people my definition of an addiction, which is a process that's manifested in any behavior that a person finds temporary relief or pleasure in, and therefore craves, suffers negative consequences in the long term, but doesn't give up despite negative consequences. So it's craving, relief, pleasure in the short term, negative consequence long term, inability or refusal to give it up. That's what an addiction is. Drugs, sex, gambling, eating, I don't care what. So Drew, I don't know how personally you wish to be here, but can I ask you, according to that definition, have you ever had an addictive pattern in your life?
Absolutely.
Okay, and I'm not going to ask what, and I don't care, or for how long. I'm going to ask you this question. Not what was wrong with the addiction, but what was right about it? What did it do for you in the short term? What did it give you that you needed or wanted at that time?
And I'm happy to be open. I've never had in what people might consider a traditional addiction, yeah, look through the Western lens of substance, but in looking it through your lens, I absolutely have. And that was the seeking and the needing of approval of other people and the severe sort of drive to people please people. And to answer your question, what did I get in return? I became known as, I was surrounded by individuals. I never felt alone.
So you got recognition, acknowledgement, and companionship. Is that the case?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. No. Is human contact, companionship, a good thing or a bad thing?
It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. So in other words, addiction wasn't your problem. Addiction was your solution to a problem. The problem was your isolation, your sense of not having value, having to have that value acknowledged. That was your problem. And the addiction came along in a certain way to solve that problem for you. But how did you get the sense that you weren't valuable, weren't worthy of contact, or isolated? That has to do with something that happened to you in childhood. In other words, the addiction was simply a compensation for something that you lost in childhood, something that you had every right to expect life to give you, something that is an essential human need. And all addictions are like that, whether it's to gambling, sex, work, shopping, I don't care what. They always give you something that you lost. So addiction is really a compensation for something lost in childhood. As to the people pleasing, well, at a certain point, there was a time in your life when your life depended on pleasing people.
Absolutely, I know it very clearly.
Okay, well, is that a good thing or a bad thing? It's a compensation, right? Now, it shouldn't have had to. You would have, ideally, life would have given you the circumstances where you accepted and valued for exactly who you were as a young child. That's a need of ours. When we don't get that, we become people pleasers. And let me tell you, I've written a book called When the Body Says No, and it's all about how these people, these chronic people pleasers who suppress themselves to please others, that's the source of so much physical illness. Because that's that the pleasing of others and suppressing your own needs to please others actually undermines your immune system. I'm talking science here. So that I'm saying so many diseases, or so many afflictions, so many mental health conditions originate as compensations for what's lost in childhood. Take something like depression. And I'm going to finish my illustrating my point with this. What does it mean to depress something? Literally, physically, what does it mean?
You got to push down to suppress it.
Exactly right. Any idea what people pushed on in depression?
Feelings, their true essence.
Right. Now, why would a human being push on their feelings?
You know, I think about it to probably survive the moment, right? To avoid conflict.
Avoid conflict, avoid the pain. So when a child is not allowed to have their emotions and is not held with their emotions, or is not allowed to express anger, they learn, for the sake of staying in relationship with their caregivers, to push these things down. And then 30 years later, they're diagnosed with this illness, so-called illness called depression. It all began as a compensation. So I hope I've illustrated my point.
Absolutely. And which brings to my next point that I wanted to bring up with that is that you always ask the question, which is, it's not about the addiction, but why the pain? Yeah. Not why the addiction, but why the pain? And I think that is a central question that we can, if we just look outside in this world, we can see that that question is not being asked when it comes to thinking about either traditional quote-unquote addictions. For those listening, I'm putting that in quotes because there's so much more of a broad band of addictions, but even all the other things that we don't see as traditional addictions that truly are.
This episode is brought to you by ButcherBox. You know, I've tried a lot of different diets, and one of the ones that I've found that feels best for my body is my friend and business partner's dietary approach. It's called the Pegan Diet. Now, a big part of the Pegan approach is to incorporate small amounts of high-quality, nutrient-dense animal protein. And one of the ways I do that is including 100% grass-fed beef a couple times a week. But I always want to make sure I'm buying meat from places that take good care of their animals, their farmers, their environment. ButcherBox meets all these criteria and more. ButcherBox goes above and beyond and only partners with family farms and ranchers who are committed to using sustainable farming practices. Plus, they make shopping way easier by delivering everything right to your doorstep. ButcherBox has a variety of different boxes, and you can choose your box and frequency. For a limited time, you can sign up today and get 2 pounds of ground beef free for a whole year, plus $10 off by going to butcherbox.com/DHRU. That's Drew. That's 2 pounds of grass-fed beef free for your first year, plus $10 off by going to ButcherBox, B-U-T-C-H-E-R, box.com/DHRU. The human body is insanely resilient. We can bounce back from a heck of a lot, and it wouldn't be at all possible without the help of our immune systems. But a healthy immune system cannot thrive without a healthy planet. You can't have one without the other. It just doesn't fly like that. Our immune health and the planet's health are intimately connected, which is why my business partner, Dr. Hyman, and I were super excited to partner with Big Bold Health, a company that's committed to protecting both. Big Bold Health is an immunity solutions company that combines natural wisdom with modern science to deliver the highest quality immune-supporting foods and supplements on the market. One of my favorite Big Bold Health products is their Himalayan Tartary Buckwheat. You've probably heard me talk about it on the podcast. It's an organic superfood grown in soils that yields higher levels of key micronutrients and gut-nourishing polyphenols for the ultimate immune-supporting benefits. Right now, Big Bold Health is offering my listeners $20 off all their products. Just go to bigboldhealth.com to get all of their products for $20 off with the code DHRU20. That's Drew20, DHRU20. And when you sign up for their subscribe and save program, you'll get free shipping on every order as well. That's bigboldhealth.com with the code DHRU, Drew, that's me, 20 at checkout.
Well, exactly. And you know, then you get depressed because you've been pushing down your feelings, or you compensate for your pain by getting addicted to heroin, or you compensate for your lack of value by becoming a workaholic, or you compensate for your sense of not being wanted by becoming a habitual sexaholic, you know? And then they tell you, there's something wrong with your brain. There's a brain disease going on. No, these are all compensations. And yes, they affect the brain, but it's not an illness that started in the brain. It's how your brain responded to life circumstances, to the pain of life. And the brain is actually shaped by life experience. So really, it's people's experience we have to look at. Why the pain? And that's the question, not only in addiction, although it certainly applies there, but in so many human conditions.
Even physical conditions. You know, we've had so many different experts in integrative and functional medicine and leading researchers in cancer. And now the new view on cancer is that cancer is not this thing that attacks the body, but it actually is a survival mechanism. Our healthy cells that are trying to survive a diseased, a diseased environment that they're being placed in. So really the idea that so much of we think of what is wrong with us, physical ailments, personality traits, compensations, addictions, are, as you said, survival mechanisms. It's action, reaction. When we understand that, we're left with the truth of now we can actually move forward.
Well, let's see, what would I say about cancer? So lots of studies. I'm just writing a new book, so I just reviewed the vast literature on this. So women who've got symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder have doubled the risk of ovarian cancer. Children who are abused in general have a higher risk of inflammatory diseases, autoimmune diseases, and cancer. And I could go on and on and on and on. The cancer, I wouldn't say directly, is a survival mechanism, but it's a product of the body's response to lifelong stress and trauma. And for example, we talk about people pleasing, and a lot of people who develop cancer have got this tendency to suppress their feelings. That suppression of feelings also suppresses the immune system, because the immune system is not separated from your emotional system. It's all one system. So then you get cancer because your immunity has been diminished. Now, what does the cancer do? Well, the cancer threatens your life. It really does. I mean, physically, it really threatens your life. And of course, often it takes your life, which is true. But what's also true is that for a lot of people that I've talked with, the cancer functions as a wake-up call and says, boy, you have not been paying attention, have you? You've not been paying attention to your own needs. You've not been paying attention to who you really are. So in that certain sense, no, I don't recommend this way of learning. I don't recommend cancer to anybody. But once it shows up, I've known so many people to whom it's been a teaching experience. In a real sense, it was a cause of rebirth of their true selves. And this has been studied. I'm not just talking airy-fairy stuff here. You know, this has been studied. And if you look at, there's a couple of books I could mention. In fact, you might want to have these people on your podcast. One of them is called Cured by Dr. Jeffrey Rediger, who's a physician and psychiatrist at Harvard. And Cured is his book where they looked at people with so-called spontaneous remissions, people who, despite the failure of medical treatment or despite the fact that they refuse medical treatment and they're supposed to die, instead their cancer goes away. And medical science doesn't study these things very much. Like, it's interesting. I talk with these people who've survived like that, and the doctors never know what they did. But what they did is, in every case, transform their relationship to themselves. They became much more authentically themselves. And that made a difference to their malignancy. Now, I'm not talking about panaceas or cure-alls. I'm just saying that when the healing happens, it has to do with a deep connection to yourself that was cut off when you were small. The cancer woke you up and you reconnected to yourself. And I've seen this in autoimmune disease, in multiple sclerosis, even in ALS, which is said to be universally terminal, but there are actually people who survived it and who've even recovered from it. You know, and in every case, it has to do with the transformation of the relationship to themselves. And Rediger is not the only one to have studied this. Other people have as well, and they published the same kind of findings. And in my own personal research, how authentically people are able to be themselves instead of identifying with all those mechanisms that you identified in yourself, the people pleasing and all that. How they're just going to be themselves. That has a huge impact on their health and illness. Again, not that I recommend it, very often comes along and says, friend, wake up. Wake up. The life you've been living is not your life.
You know, when a lot of people are first introduced to your work, because so much of the connection of addiction and pain is related to early childhood experiences, those formative years where we are still developing our sense of who we are. So it's natural that we develop it by attaching to the form of the people that are around us. So if our parents are in pain, as they're in stress, as you've shared with your story, your mother not even knowing if she was going to survive, having to give you two family members, and you even talking about her calling the doctor and saying, you know, my son just keeps on crying, like, we need to do something. And he's like, all my Jewish baby patients are crying. They're all crying right now.
Yeah, this is right after the Nazis occupied Hungary and all the Jewish babies were crying. And you can generalize this, you know. In any situation where the parents are stressed or under or struggling and afraid, the energy is picked up by the kids. And not only is it picked up by the kids think it's about themselves, so somehow it's their fault. So some people will grow up with a kind of guilt that they don't even realize what the source of it is. And the source of the guilt is that they didn't make their parents happy. They couldn't have made them happy. It wasn't their job. But as children, we take this on automatically. And so that a huge source of shame and guilt in this world, people say, as addicted people, of course I'm ashamed. No, you were ashamed before you were addicted.
One preceded the other.
The shame preceded the addiction. And by the way, this is true not only for addiction, but all kinds of conditions and all kinds of illnesses, as I've written in my other books, so that our self-concept develops in interaction with our parents. And children are narcissistic. And that, I don't mean that as a negative statement. I mean, in the genuine meaning of the word, they think it's all about them. So Thich Nhat Hanh, the spiritual teacher who I'm sure you know of, he said that the Buddhist teacher, he said that the biggest gift parents can give their kids is their own happiness. And the reason for that is children are narcissistic. if my parents are happy, oh, I must be a great guy. I must be a good person. I must really be lovable. Hey, aren't I just wonderful? But if my parents are stressed and unhappy, guess whose fault it is? If they get divorced, guess whose fault it is? On the unconscious level, it's about me. It's my fault. If my mother was unhappy, it was my fault. Not that it really was, but that's how the child perceives it. And so that sense of shame and failure and guilt, it precedes everything. And it's got nothing to do with who you are and what you've done or haven't done.
And I think that sometimes when people hear that, because we all go through this, it's sort of the universal experience of humanity, and they're introduced to your work, there's almost this feeling of like, so now you're saying that everything is my parents' fault, and you have a great explanation around this that I'd love you to expand upon, because it's like these early childhood experiences impact us. We're devoid of a feeling or have something missing in our life. Then there's adaptations that come from that, that if they're not met over a period of time can turn into these versions of addictions that are there. So is it all our parents' fault?
Well, I never use the word fault. It's not a concept that exists in my understanding of things, because the logic then is, well, why were my parents like that? Did my mother create the Second World War? Did she invite the Nazis into Budapest? If your father was an alcoholic, where did that start? In his childhood. Okay, great, let's blame his parents. But wait a minute, why were his parents like that? Oh, well, let's blame their parents. By that logic, we end up going back blaming Adam and Eve or some poor ape ancestor sitting in a tree eating a banana, you know? Like, in other words, there's no end to the blame game. And there's a book, a title which I like very much, is by a family assistance therapist called Mark Woolen, and the book is called It Didn't Begin With You. It didn't begin with any of us. It's not personal. And like Eckhart says, the ego is not personal. It's just what happens to people. So no parent deliberately screws up their kids. It's not a fault. Look, when my kids are small, I would lose my temper. I was a workaholic. I was there for my patients. What a wonderful doctor who's always available. Guess where that leaves his kids?
The shoemaker's son. Yeah. Shoemaker's kids with no shoes.
Exactly. Yeah, it was the same story. And so why was I doing that? Because as an infant, I got the sense that the world didn't want me. So if the world doesn't want me, you know what you do? You know what you do if the world doesn't want you? Go to medical school. Then they're going to want you all the time. They're going to want you when they're born, when they die, and at every moment in between, they have any problem, they're going to want you. Now you can keep proving to yourself how important you are every second. But when my kids experience a father who's always working, who's always on a beeper, a cell phone, delivering babies at night, not available on weekends, what message do they get? That they're not wanted. I'm passing on the same message. Did I do it deliberately? Did I wake up one morning and said, I'm going to screw up my kids? Was it my fault? I didn't know myself. And as Eckhart says, without consciousness, there's no responsibility. There's no without awareness. So there's no point talking about fault. It's a question of just being compassionate towards every generation, towards everybody. And realizing that we got caught up in these patterns, and then we pass on these patterns, not because it's our fault, but because we don't know any better.
Yeah, and you have a great quote. I'll just paraphrase it here because you just kind of said it, but there is no responsibility without that consciousness. Without that awareness, there is no responsibility. And there's a difference between responsibility and fault.
Right. Right. Yeah. Fault is. Only comes into it if I consciously know something, I'm totally aware of it, and I quite deliberately, for selfish reasons, go against what I know to be true. That's very rare. That's actually very rare. Now, unless there's also a difference between fault and responsibility. Yes, it's my responsibility how I lived my life. I did it. I mean, I did it out of certain patternings. It wasn't my fault. But who's going to respond to all that if I'm not me? Who's responsible if it's not me? So taking responsibility means that once I realize something, I do what I can to clean it up. That's how you take responsibility. But that's got nothing to do with fault. It's nothing to do with, not that I haven't blamed myself. Believe me, I have. That's, you have to really learn not to blame yourself. But responsibility and blame are two different things.
Connect for me here, while we still have a little bit of time, connect for me here what you perceive to be, you know, the experiences that you went through as a child and how that mapped out to these addictive patterns. Like, what actually is taking place in the brain and in the body to create a connection between those two?
Okay, so if you look at the addicted brain, there's a number of circuits that just don't work very well. One of them is the endorphin circuitry. Endorphins are our internal opiates. We have our internal opiates. We have receptors for opiates. That's why the heroin works, is because we have receptors. But why do we have receptors? Because we have our own substances internal to ourselves that look very similar to heroin. So we have endorphin receptors. So we have an endorphin system in our brain. What do the endorphins do? They provide pain relief, physical and emotional pain relief, which is necessary for life. They give us a sense of pleasure and reward, joy, elation. And they connect us to other people. So then endorphins are one of the attachment chemicals, along with the oxytocin, that keeps us connected to people that we have to stay close to. Why? To survive. So infants have to attach and connect with their parents. And the parents have to connect and attach to the infants. Otherwise, there's no infant survival, given the helplessness of the human infant. So we have these brain chemicals that help to modulate our attachments. So we have their brain circuitry. That circuitry doesn't function well in addicted people. So heroin, boy, all of a sudden they have love and connection and pain relief and pleasure, which are totally normal human aspirations. As a sex trade worker with HIV said to me once, the first time I did heroin, she said, it felt like a warm, soft hug. So the opiates are really all about love. Then there's the dopamine circuitry. Dopamine is our incentive motivation circuitry. We have receptors for dopamine. We have brain centers and nuclei that work on dopamine. Without dopamine, we're lifeless, we're inert, we lack vigor, incentive, no motivation to do anything. Dopamine flows when you're seeking food or a sexual partner. You can see how important that is. People who are prone to addiction, the dopamine circuits don't function very well. And that's where the addictions take root. So when you're addicted to work, it's not the work that you're addicted to. It's the dopamine that's released in your brain through that activity. That's what you're addicted to. So even the non-substance addicts are substance addicts, except they get those substances released internally, triggered by whatever their target behavior is. So the sex addict gets their dopamine from sexual seeking, the gambler from gambling, the cocaine addict from cocaine. But they're all after the same hit of dopamine. Other circuits that don't work so well are stress regulation, circuits in the brain whose job is to calm our stress so our body doesn't go into overdrive. And impulse regulation, so that I may feel like doing something, but something says, no, Gabor, not a good idea, don't do it. Addicts don't have that. They keep doing what they know is bad for them. These circuits in the brain develop in childhood. in interaction with the environment. So this is what we have to get about the brain. The brain is a dynamic social organ. Its circuitry, its systems development, the availability of receptors for the neurochemicals like serotonin and oxytocin and vasopressin and GABA and the endorphins and dopamine, they all develop in interaction with our environment. And the more stressed the environment is, the less these circuits develop properly and the more prone you are to be addicted later on. So you can see, for example, even already in utero, like if you stress mothers, that'll affect their children's dopamine receptors and their stress regulation. Those kids will be more prone to be addicted later on because of what happened in utero. So yes, it is about the brain, but the brain is not the primary source. The brain itself is under the effect of life history and life experience, which also means that if we change our life experience and our relationship to ourselves, it's no easy task. We can actually change our brains. So that's the beauty of it.
And the first step is awareness, would you say?
Well, without that, there's no other steps. So, but when you say awareness, what do you mean by that?
The recognition of that space that we talked about, just at least a glimpse, not that it's going to be there with us always, but that we are not our wrong patterns. We are not our addictions. We are not these things that are, we are not our father who was an alcoholic. We are not these things. We are not our life events. They've happened to us. I think that that's partly what I mean through awareness.
Fair enough. And so even in the 12-step groups, when somebody says, my name is so-and-so and I'm an addict, there's value in that, and that the person is recognizing and owning their behavior. But at the same time, it's a double-edged sword because nobody is an addict. That's not who they are. The addiction was a pattern of behavior which came along, as we pointed out before, to soothe some kind of pain. So it'd be more accurate to stand up and say, hello, my name is Gabor, or my name is Drew, and I've had pain in my life which I've soothed through this particular behavior. But that's not who I am. That's just my behavior. That's just my coping mechanism. That'd be more accurate. And yeah, that's where awareness comes in.
So once awareness, the next component, which a big part of awareness is getting connected to, there was pain first. And that pain created the void to go, with lack of awareness or with unconsciousness, to go find things to put into that void. So is the next component to begin to unravel the pain?
Well,
feel the pain?
You know, there's no one size fits all. But for me, if we don't go there, if we simply focus on the behaviors, you know, you're a drinker and you want to stop drinking, well, that's good. But very often that hasn't dealt with the fundamental addiction process in your brain. You've just stopped a certain behavior. And very often people that stop one behavior, they go into another. People who stop smoking very often will put on weight. Why? Because that emptiness is still there. So for me, while it's good to work on the behaviors, obviously, ultimately healing has to do with working through that pain and working through the trauma and finding your deeper, truer self underneath all that. Which, by the way, if you look at the word recovery, I mean, I say this all the time, it's almost a cliche, but recovery, what does it mean to recover something? It means to find it. You've lost contact with something, you've lost touch with it, and you've found it, so you've recovered it. So when we say, I've recovered, what have people recovered? And if you talk to people who've been through addictions, and you ask them, well, what did you recover? What did you find? Oh, I found myself. So that's what ultimately recovery is. But to do that, you have to work through the pain, for sure.